I knew who I didn't like as a leader and who I liked as a leader, because I had several of them. And I think the people who were almost, in terms of outcome versus almost to a point of they want to, I don't care what's happening in your life, but you need to do this. That kind of statements didn't gel well with me. And there were some leaders that were those kinds of leaders. Versus, you know, collaboration, I am at the back, I'm the last person. And if you need me to be the 12th man carrying the water bottle or score a running touchdown, I will do whatever is needed to fill the gap.
Welcome to a new season of Breaking Resistance, where we will be bringing you incredible stories of finding the path through resilience, tenacity, and hard work. We showcase the power of human perseverance with an amazing list of guests. I'm your host, Jalal John Azar, with my co-host, Francisco Herrera. You can tune in every Monday and Thursday for full episodes, educational mini-episodes, and lots of laughs as we keep it real with a whole lot of golden nuggets sprinkled in. Find out more on our website at www.peak15cap.com. Thank you for listening. Now, let's get to the show. All right, welcome everybody to another exciting episode to Breaking Resistance. And I am super psyched today because I have a tremendous friend and colleague and cohort and collaborator. So many labels I can throw on this guy for me, and a superstar that we've been aiming to have him on the podcast forever. And it's just been going back and forth for a while. So finally it's here. The day is here.
It's here.
Where we have our esteemed Hemal Badiani in here, but I'll let Francisco introduce himself first and then Hemal.
Yeah. So thanks again for joining us, Breaking Resistance. So again, like John mentioned, trying to get Hemal, but he's just busy dude is just making it happen in the market. So I think everyone's going to really get a kick out of today's episode. So Hemal, we'd like to welcome you to the show.
I'm extremely excited. Thank you guys for inviting me. And you guys are doing some tremendous work, and I look to sharing my journey and learn from you guys over the course of this conversation as well.
Yeah, no, it's actually the opposite, man. We're trying to learn from you. So we're trying to keep up to your level. But for our listeners, I mean, John and I know you very well. We've been trying to work on some projects together, but just for our listeners, if you can kind of give us a 30,000 on yourself, your background, and then we can kind of dive in a little bit further on your journey.
Yep. Yeah. 42 years age, husband, father of twin babies, now 7-year-old, 7.5 years old, boy and a girl. I grew up in India for the first 19 years of my life. Then I came to this land of opportunities, came here to study, and then moved around to London to chase my then girlfriend, now my wife, of 17 years. And that led me to a path from a professional standpoint to management consulting across 3 continents, whereby I worked with everybody from Disney theme parks to the Vatican. You know, really, really insightful journey there. And then that gig took me around every week from a journey standpoint, really worked with very, very smart CEOs, COOs to help them shape their businesses, whether it's cost cutting, mergers, product innovation, strategy, and really help me hone my skill set and competency. And then once my kids were born, I decided to hang up my traveling boots. That allowed me to then transition to a much more peaceful position at the bank. I was senior vice president with one of the banks for a few years. And after changing a few thousand diapers, I started getting bored. So I decided to think about introspect of where I needed to be, what my superpowers were. And that led me to a journey of scaling multiple businesses, starting from an outsourcing company, then a private lending company, then a residential real estate, and then eventually we've got a commercial real estate company. So a commercial real estate arm after all those businesses is this snapshot in time. It's 30 months old. We went to from 0 to $150 million in assets under development and management. We've got 13 people in the company and super excited for the next phase of where we are in terms of the market and what we are trying to do in this beautiful game of commercial real estate.
That is awesome. Now we're going to go ahead and dissect that. I know there was a lot for a lot of folks. But being the fact that you have already honed a really good skill, which is diaper management, so kudos to that. So, I mean, you have probably already one of the top skills that most folks don't already have. So, but we'll go ahead and let's dissect that a little bit, because you took us on an entire journey, but we want to kind of get really into the weeds. So kind of take us into like what that looked like in childhood for you in those 19 years that you were in India. Like, what was that upbringing for you before transitioning?
Yeah, it was very unique from my vantage point. It was a mid-sized town back in India. And if you think about India as a diamond, on the west side of India is a state called Gujarat, where most of the big entrepreneurs come from. So there's a lot of entrepreneurial hustling spirit. My father and my granddad were both entrepreneurs. I think it's just a proximity mindset. It seems like there's just people that want to be on their own, be their own boss. They believe that provision of their own time and working hard would lead to some level of scalability. So that's what leadership has been defined there for the most part. Not that there are no employees there, but a lot of people just want to hustle at the next level that I don't even think I can be successful at in terms of how they deal with volume and margin in an uber competitive environment with 1.5 billion people. That is your market, right? So, but that's where I grew up. My granddad was a big influence for me. He studied till third grade in one of the Indian languages, but he could speak 11 languages. And he wasn't over religious or anything, but he wanted people to come to our house and debate, right? And so he would invite philosophers and poets and politicians, and they would debate on different topics. So growing up, it was just a great exposure from a other person's point of view, and no side is completely right type of exposure. There was a lot of intelligent conversations that shaped where we wanted to be. And then my schooling was very unique as well. I was studying at a convent school, which in the Indian entire 1.5 billion population, there's probably 2-3% of Christian population. So going into a convent school, it's a mixed bag because your teachers, many of them are nuns and priests with a mixed bag of other teachers. So you start the day with a Catholic prayer, and then you go into a Sanskrit hymn for, which is another 5,000-year-old language, for the Indian national anthem as an example. So it was a mixed bag of exposure that allowed us to kind of, that was the growing part. But literally growing up as a prince, that was the third thing. For the first 19 years of my life, I never ironed a shirt. And magically, my clothes appeared in my closets. Never cut an onion in my life. You know, the dry cleaners had a special door in my household. They come from the back door, and then, you know,
the dry cleaners had a special door in your house?
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah. Wow. And this is not ultra wealthy also. It's labor's cheap. Right? So if you're middle class, upper middle class, you got a couple of cooks in the house, cleaners in the house, right? Cleaners coming in and writing a notepad. You know, I took away 20 clothes, and at the end of the month, you settle up the account. So I didn't get to do it. So it was a very non-use from that standpoint, very idealistic environment for me. Where I hadn't seen the grind and hustle of life that my father and my granddad had seen.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. That is amazing. I'm always fascinated because Himmel, you know, I'm an immigrant myself, and, you know, my experience wasn't similar to yours, but it was definitely a whole lot different from sort of the Americana experience that we would have here now, that we experience now with our family and able to provide the best we can, even though we're not providing necessarily or not living the same lifestyle as we did before. How do you think that growing up like that kind of shaped how you eventually became? What did you take away from that, from your childhood, that made Himmel the man that he is today, the father that he is today?
Yeah, I think the global exposure to a certain extent to say there's multiple religions, there's multiple points of view, there's multiple ways of thinking about a single problem. And there's that level of acceptance that I developed over the childhood where I wasn't ever too opinionated, right? I'm very assertive, and I know, and I'm very clear with the vision and the company's goals and stuff. But if somebody taps on my shoulder and says, hey, you might want to look at it this way, I mean, I always say, you may all have your say, but you may all not have your way with me. So I'm always open to a lot of feedback, and that makes me an eternal learner.
that helps me shape even for my kids. So that was one thing. And the second thing was just conversations, right? The ability to have right conversations at different ages with me as a father and with my kids has allowed me to have insight into their lives, shape, you know, even bigger things. Now they're 7 years old. They talk about the universe and what does that mean? And what does debt mean? What does finances mean? And my daughter gets to, you know, use the credit card. And so all those aspects that they won't learn in the school or me, you know, as easy or approachable to talk about nowadays or even before. It's just made it very natural for me to have those kinds of conversations very consciously as well.
Okay. Yeah. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, no, and you mentioned that, and just going back, you said your grandfather, that, correct me if I'm wrong, was a grandfather who knew 11 languages and bring philosophers in to have those type of like debate and those conversations that were just, that fascinates me, the fact that, I mean, to have that kind of exposure, that type of conversations, especially at a young age for you, I mean, that must have been just something that's just an eye-opener. Because, I mean, you talk about now about your daughter, the conversations you're having now, but I can only imagine the conversations you guys were having, knowing the fact that your grandfather was just setting this up for you guys, for generations, for you guys to also be molded as you're continuing to grow up. I mean, that's fascinating.
Yeah. For him, general learning was table stakes. Right? It was just, you are a lifelong, he was a very sharp cookie. And at the age of 88, before he passed away, he would still, you know, at 86, I didn't even want to drive a scooter with my grandma behind her, behind him. And I'm like, granted, time out. You know, you got a couple of cars. Come on. You don't need to do this. You break the hip, you're done. But he would go to the office every day. He's like, if I don't work, I'll die. And so it kept his mind sharp. Yeah.
So would you say he was a bigger, because a lot of times it's okay. Like, listen, we have parents, and a lot of times our parents, obviously we love our parents dearly, but sometimes our parents are not necessarily the biggest influence on us, on our life. Sometimes other people are. In your case, do you think your grandfather was probably more influencer on your life than your parents are?
In the early years, right? In the early years when my dad was hustling, he was taking over my granddad's business. He was trying to expand it. He was busy. And that meant my granddad, because we stayed in a joint family when my grandparents lived with us, it allowed me to spend more time with my grandmother and grandfather than my parents in the early years. And they both helped me shape with love and with intelligence. They used to take me to the Taekwondo classes of those days and all of that. My granddad used to do that rather than my dad. In the later years, you know, I really appreciated my father's style. He's my biggest influencer right now. He's a big jokester, doesn't take life seriously, stays in his lane. He loves, you know, playing pranks, and just life is a big game to him. So, yeah, even at this stage, when I am on a call with him, it's a laugh ride, and that allows us to stay beyond this whole, you know, we're building something and legacy and all the conversations that we have philosophically with ourselves. Just at the end of the day,
that's awesome.
Amazing, amazing.
That's really cool. That's really cool.
It's beautiful, man.
This is a weird question, but what language do you speak when you speak with your parents or like your family? Do you speak in English or do you speak in another language?
Now, so with my kids, it's English. With my wife and my parents, it's the state language. So if you know, India has, I think, 786 dialects and languages. So this being one of the major 10 or 12 languages, the state has a language called Gujarati. So that's what we converse in.
Okay. I know it's a weird question because I'm always like, again, same thing with me. Like, I know I converse with my family in Arabic for the most part, but, you know, a lot of times we switch tongues really quickly and speak in English, you know, when it comes time, when there's mixed company, especially, or you know, when we're conversational, like with my brother, like I'm always conversing in English for some reason. We don't converse in Arabic, but with my mom and my sisters, we converse in Arabic. So it's just kind of weird, but
it is. Same person can speak two languages or three languages, and whatever you used to, that's the language you go with, and that's how you think and sometimes dream even.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So moving forward, you came to the U.S. How did you get into management consulting? What did you do earlier on?
Yeah. So my U.S. story, I'll tell you a little snippet there. So again, my naive 19-year-old self, my dad's taking a siesta one afternoon. This town used to take siestas in India and still does from 1 to 4 for the most part. Right. So I'm waking him up. I'm like, Dad, I got an idea. I have one friend that I know that's in my high school that just moved to this town called Charlotte in the United States. I don't know anyone else. I just know this dude and I want to go there. And he's like, dude, well, whatever, right? You don't even know what exams to give. What are we talking? Why are you waking me up at this stage, right?
He's like, what is this Charlotte? Don't you want to go to New York, Boston, San Francisco? Yeah. Like, where the hell is this Charlotte?
Yeah, he didn't take me at all seriously. But I'm like, he said, yeah. So I took it as a yes. Obviously, it was a sleepy yes. Well, don't bother me type of yeah. But so I started giving exams and I started application. Only one college I'm applying because in the whole of the country, I know one person. And so I got my acceptance at UNCC, UNC Charlotte. And 2 months before I'm supposed to move here, I got my dad convinced. 2 months before I was supposed to move here, that dude that I knew moved back. So when I land here, it's zero people that I know. And that's when my education started. And that was 2 years of complete shock, culture shock. I'm housed with 6 other people, random strangers. I don't know what I'm doing. I had to find my first gig was at Chick-fil-A and then, you know, Burger King. I worked at gas stations, laundromats, summer jobs, you know, seller finance, my first car, 92 Buick Century. Then I'm driving 7 days a week to basically and go to the gigs. And so it was a big transitionary period for me. And that's when my girlfriend at that time, she had moved to the UK. So we decided to, you know, continue our relationship long distance. And she came to the US and I came to the UK visit. And we're like, all right, this is going to, at some point, once we graduate, we got to move to one town. And London seems kind of cooler than Charlotte. So why don't you move to London? So I moved to London, got married, and then, you know, started the job applications. We didn't know what to do. We stayed at a grandma's place, you know, $400 in hand. Didn't want to ask money from our parents. They're like, we'll figure this out. So started applying and I got 2 applications processed in a few months. And one of them was in management consulting. And so that's how I started my career. It was completely accidental. It was the first gig and they were paying the highest out of the 2 that job offers I had.
Unbelievable.
That's
awesome.
Yeah. Well, going back to the culture shock, because I mean, that must have been terrifying at some point, because the main purpose of the leap was because you knew somebody going to Charlotte. Now it's him on his own by himself, knows nobody. And I mean, and the story is very similar to John's. I mean, I can see why the both of you connected really, really well, because I mean, it's a totally different world. Here, you're by yourself. So tell us a little bit about like that experience of you I'm sure there was a lot of hurdles and everything like that were hitting you one after the other because you're by yourself. So just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'll give you a couple of examples, right? One, I mean, beyond the culture shock and the first couple of months of crying, you know, the one thing I knew about myself was there's no turning back. If I made a decision, we're going with it. I already told my dad, I'm going to be fine. Whatever funds I calculated is all I need. I'm not going to need any more. So I got to figure this out by myself. I don't know. I don't have any skills at all, right? So I'm trying to find the jobs. And then we are 6 folks living together in this 1, 2, 3 floor town hall by the university. And 3 of us know cooking. 3 of us don't. I mean, I don't know it. And I didn't know how to make noodles, right? At all. So every time I go and work at the first place that accepted us was Chick-fil-A, and I still have nightmares of filleting 2,000 pieces of chicken every day in the freezer. Moving from India, right? So I'm tired, and by the 3rd week, I'm chasing and stalking this manager from Burger King, and like, guy, please, can you give me a job there? Because this job is killing me. It's back-breaking. I don't want to do this. And so, you know, I'm trying to transition my job. I'm trying to figure out all the courses and the credits and all those systems and walking to the place. We don't have any cars or cell phones or laptops or nothing. And then when I come home, these 3 dudes who knew how to cook, they were
think they're, you know, some celebrity chef or something. So every time they use a ladle, they're like, oh, somebody else is cleaning this, you know? So they made one piece of meat, but it's like a stockpile of utensils that I have to come home and I clean up because it's my job.
Were they Indian or were they American, by the way?
Yeah, they were all Indian.
Okay. Well, at least that was easier for you than to.
That was easier. It was all, yeah. Again, the different cultures within India. It's like, you know, European Union. So many of them spoke languages that were Greek to me and their native tongues. Everybody knew pretty much Hindi, a national language, and could converse in English. So that was a good common denominator. But they grew up different exposures, different lifestyles, different culture. There was still an amalgamation of things and, you know, personality stuff. Yeah, so that one prompted me to start learning how to cook. And the first time I put a pressure cooker and put lentils in there, I didn't even know, since how naive I was back then, I didn't know how to, then you have to actually get the pressure off before you open it. So I did the most dangerous thing you can do and just open the whole thing. They blasted off, yellow washed the walls, you know, it's all yellow curry and lentil soup on the wall. And learned cooking because I didn't want to clean all the time, learned how to iron my shirts and, you know, got into life. I still hate ironing shirts, by the way. That's one thing I don't want to do. Yeah.
Well, you're no longer filleting chicken though. That's good. That's, you know, it's
that's been great.
That's amazing. Oh man. I can sympathize with almost all of that. So, not the Chick-fil-A. I think I got my first job my first job ever here in the United States was at a movie theater. I was like an usher pouring popcorn, like doing the concession. That was my first job ever here in the United States.
That's awesome. And the other thing, one thing I mentioned is, I don't know if you come from a different culture, there's a sense of, like, you know, certain jobs are reserved for folks that are middle class or upper middle class. So I'm here as a student. I got a Burger King job and everything's easy peasy, frying fries and burgers and all of that. And through the day, through your shift, at the end of the shift, you have two choices. One, either you can take the trash out and basically walk around the cafeteria and send 100 other students, and some of them now know you, wearing your Burger King clothes and you know, picking up the trash and putting it in the place and then go to the compactor and get the trash kind of compacted. Or you get to wash and clean all the crud from the frying machine, which is back. But I would almost, for the first few months, I would almost volunteer for that back-breaking stuff. I am like, I'm not doing that. That's stupid, right? I have to put my hand down. I'm not picking trash out. And 100 people, that's too much egoistic for me, right? I didn't come from that. That's how I used to think. And then I found out that people pick the trash, they go out for a smoke, and they're chilling out for an hour and a half while doing all this compacting, while we are breaking our backs with all the cleaning and mopping the floors and everything. And they're like, this seems to be great. And it took me 6 months, whistled out a hallway while picking some trash and learning that you know, every job comes at its own price and every job is important and you take what you get.
Hey, those guys figured out the hustle of the end of the shift. They figured it out. They figured it out. You have to game the system. So, oh man, that is awesome. Now you're in London, and you landed your first job as a management consultant. Was it with like a big firm, like a global firm, or like with a firm that was?
Yep, it was with Accenture. Which was when I joined back in 2003, 2004 was 65,000 people. Now it's probably 600,000 employees. It's a true global. So I started with the London office. They used to ship me around all over Europe and actually within the UK. So my first gig, which was this massive, massive project, £2-3 billion. So probably $4 billion worth of a project that they had won for the National Health Service of the UK. They're trying to change all the doctor systems and everything. So 1,500 of us from 35 different companies in 35 different countries, subcontracting for Accenture, were housed in this new location in Leeds, which is about 2.5 hours from London. So I would go every Monday by train, come back every Friday. I'm married, so my wife's waiting for me. That's how we spend our weekend. And, you know, stay there for 5 days. And
oh, at that point, you're married. At that point, you're
married.
At that point, you're married.
Yep, we got married. But yeah, that's how I started my career for 4 years to 5 years in the UK. You know, I'd done my partying and clubbing and enjoying the UK life. And I quickly realized that the January blues are real, man. They're the three-day plastic ball that surrounds the sky where you don't even get a ray of sunshine. It's just terrible. It wasn't great for me. My mood sunk in those months. And so I'm like, Accenture, you got a Charlotte office. I, you know, convinced my wife things that can I bear to move to Charlotte and said, you know, I have quite a few friends here. The weather's nice. I was going to ask,
why did you even choose Charlotte again? I'm just curious. It's like,
just
you know,
a sense of belonging here, because I knew if I had to restart again, that journey that I'd taken where I didn't know anybody the first time was just too scary. So I'm like, now I have
a
few colleagues. My wife and I actually got hosted by a few friends. We stayed at their place for a few weeks for her to see how beautiful Charlotte is before we made the decision. And then asked my Accenture as a company to move here, and then started working here for the last, you know, from 2008 is when we moved down to, I think, 2015 is when I left Accenture. So a lot of 7 years of working with them.
When you made your move out to Charlotte, were you still working with the Vatican? Or tell us a little bit about that story. So I'm kind of intrigued by that.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the Vatican. Yeah, that's what I want to hear about. The little birdie mentioned the Vatican. So let's go back to that one.
Yeah, so it was, you know, different in the management consulting world. Even since I was 22 years old, you know, you're basically going on the other side of the team, going to a client side. The clients might state that, hey, I have an issue or a problem or a challenge, and I'm hiring you guys to either solve it, or I don't know what my problem is, but I want to do X. And then you bring in a team of consultants, and you might stay there for 3 months, 6 months, 5 weeks, 2 years, 3 years, whatever that challenge requires. Then at some point, move out of that client space. So what it taught me before I go into the story, it was just because, you know, I did probably 24 projects within that 15 years time frame. And almost every project, I have a different client, obviously. It's a different environment. You get placed in the closet or given a plush office. You don't know what's coming up to you, how receptive they are as a company beyond the leadership who hired them to even solve this. And they might think that the consultant's coming in, cutting jobs. You have to create your own team members and lead them. So you have to read people really nicely. You have to understand the organizational politics. And there's just a lot of skill set, soft skill set developed and the leadership that a consultant has as a generalist, because they can be in any spot and they can figure things out, right? It's problem solving at that level. So that was my journey for 15 years. But out of that one, I think when I was in the US, we had the Vatican Ministry of Communications engaging us and saying, we want to understand how to build an omni-channel strategy for our Catholic population. We want to reach out to them more through mobile and blogs and other websites and other things, that there's more outreach. And so it wasn't like I was working with the Pope or anything. It was one of the departments that actually needed a strategy to figure out how best to do what they do, is communicate with their people. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah. I like it.
Don't know a lot of people like who actually had the Vatican as their client. So it's definitely a big thing.
Definitely a big thing. Yeah, it's fun times. There were quite a few fun gigs. And then you build a sense of camaraderie. People followed me when I started the leadership journey into different projects. I figured out how good a leader I am, what kind of leader I am. So there was a lot of introspection there as well.
For sure.
So what did you figure out? Early on, what was your impression of yourself as a leader? And what was your impression of leadership? Not just what kind of leader you are, but what was your impression of what leadership was like?
Yeah, I think I knew who I didn't like as a leader and who I liked as a leader, because I had several of them. And I think the people who were almost, in terms of outcome versus almost to a point of they want to, I don't care what's happening in your life, but you need to do this. That kind of statements didn't gel well with me. And there were some leaders that were those kinds of leaders versus, you know, collaboration. I am at the back. I'm the last person. And if you need me to be the 12th man carrying the water bottle or score a running touchdown, I will do whatever is needed to fill the gap. And if you got it, you can come to me, Nick, and or she will come daily and ask me 5 times what do you need help with, and I will do that as well. So that level of flexibility and understanding my role as a leader, then I'm looking at the forward thinking. I've got a team that's, if I've chosen them right, they're good people, they're rock stars in their own lanes and competencies, and I'm driving the ship with multiple rudders. And you really need to make sure everyone's kind of going in the right way. There's something slowing down and fixing that rather than trying to give orders to everyone, even though they might be doing some great work. So that was the biggest takeaway for me and how I shaped my leadership going forward.
And then did you end up changing your stance on your leadership as you became a leader yourself and after when you established Exponential and all that kind of stuff? So how did that change as you now, in a true way, establish yourself as a leader?
Yeah, I think my stance has been pretty similar as this was developed, that's the style of leader I want to be. I think the two things I added to my leadership toolkit was, one, you know, building loyalties, which money can't buy. And I had so much vested time and energy into many of my direct reports, middle management, that they were actually following me. They're like, Emil, I don't care which role you give me. I just want to work with you because you're a great leader. And as you grow up in the ladder, corporate ladder, you know, I'll be going up with you as well. And so there was a sense of loyalty that got translated as I built my commercial real estate business, of people just getting attracted from that standpoint. And then the second thing is, you know, what I added, which I didn't have to do too much, was feeding more bad news and how to give them, right? So it was, you know, firing people, you know, negotiating tough contracts, all those things, whether you're a servant leader in more collaborative type of natural leadership type of stance, it's harder for you to do those things. It's painful. And so I had to develop that muscle consciously to say, hey guys, this is not going to work. I love you, but you know, I'd love to work with you maybe the next time. And that has been condition that I had to, that comes with the CEO hat that, you know, I didn't have, even though I was a leader, senior leader in many of those organizations.
Yeah.
No, 100%. And Hemel, I'm curious, what is your take on self-made of someone when they say I am self-made? And the reason I ask is because you've been around a lot of leaders. And so I'm curious, as you went through a lot of stuff, and most, I know this is something that a lot of folks, even today, entrepreneurs, they say, oh, well, I'm a self-made either millionaire, or I'm self-made by myself. I did all this by myself. I had humble beginnings, but I am where I am today because of me. But I find it's all perspective, and I find it hard for me to be able to swallow that because, again, we're built up by a lot of our cohorts or our leaders, our mentors who are around us. Those are the ones who really mold us, and we're really not self-made. We're made of who we are today by the little things that we learn and we value from those who are around us and who brought us up. So I'm curious, what is your perspective or your thoughts on being self-made?
Yeah, this is where I get to give a consultant's answer. There it is, right? It depends on how you look at it, right? So if I am standing next to a person that doesn't have the drive, and we both find the most amazing mentor, what I imbibe into my, you know, daily routines or learnings versus what that other person, him or her, would do is going to be completely different. So there's a sense of drive, hunger, a passion, and intelligence within you that allows you to take those sources of information from external factors and all the things that are out there to kind of process it and utilize it. Just keep it as knowledge that you can, you know, provide to people over a conversation, actually implement and execute it. And that's the self part. But then to your point, you know, all that information is coming from the synergy of the universe, and whoever says it's truly, he or she is truly self-made, doesn't understand the laws of the universe. You're just a speck within the entirety of all the things that are happening, and you're here at this stage because there's other things happening around you that you might not even provide perspective to, because you're in that spotlight and you can't provide that floodlight of all the events that are happening, and our brains can't even process them. So there's both sides to it. There's something in me that allows me to do things uniquely and work with people that nobody else would, versus what's in you and how your journey is driven. And so there's that self-made part as well.
That's deep. That's deep, man. I can see why you're a superstar as a consultant, man. You know, yeah, you just, you know, that's why you got the, that's why you got the Vatican gig. That's why. That's why he put you on the Vatican gig. Because you're able to reach down in there, man. Yeah, I like it. It is true, though. It is true. I mean, the way that each person's journey is different, and just the way that I agree with you to a large extent about like what my journey and what my, the way that I approach things and resolving issues and resolving problems. And it may not be the same as somebody else that is working with me or for me or whatever, but there are some commonalities that we have to share in order for that dynamic to work. So they may not, you know, like, you know, Francisco and I, you know, obviously are partners, but you know, we don't do exactly the same thing. We don't look at things the same. We don't necessarily, you know, but we both have the same insatiable hunger and drive and attitude about getting things done.
Absolutely.
That we share. That is something I don't have to necessarily convince Francisco about, or, and he doesn't have to convince me about. It's already there, you know, so that because that's something you can't necessarily create in somebody else.
They either
have it or they don't have it.
Yeah, I always tell people when I hire drill sergeants, right? They should have these four qualities: driven, resilient, high integrity, and loyalty. Competence for certain functions can be taught, but those four things have to come from within, and either you have it or you don't.
Competence is information. To me, competence is just information. And the word competence is only really the use of certain information, using your personality, using your drive, leveraging your higher level cognitive skills, your higher level commitments and integrity and communication, all that kind of stuff. All of that comes into playing into your competence, but the underlying data that goes into competence could be taught. That could be taught from anybody. I mean, you know, Francisco and I, when we look at bringing anybody else new on board with us at Peak 15, I don't necessarily look for just their skills. I could care less about their skills. I can teach anybody about commercial real estate. I can't teach someone their own self-drive. That's something I cannot teach.
Exactly. And the way that I build businesses is, you know, I think about like the Fortune 100 companies and, for example, a bank, right? And think about bank and its divisions. There's a consumer division, there's a mortgage division, there's a credit card division, there's a lending division. And now if refinances are not cheap, your lending division can slow down, but your credit card debt goes high and you might have more volume there. So at the end of the day, what verticals allow you to do is, you know, have more predictable top line and bottom line. But to create each of those divisions, you need someone at the helm of those divisions. And I've literally made businesses around once I find someone like that. It doesn't have to be that I went looking for that person. If I find someone, I'm like, that's amazing. I'm going to build a business around you. And that's how we created the company. And so you're absolutely right. If you have that in you, and if you can recognize it in that in another person, there's magic that's going to happen if you synergize with that person.
That is amazing.
100%.
I love that.
I agree.
I love how you put that. It's like you find that one person that the things you can teach, that desire, that hunger, you build a business around them. I like how you word that. Yep. That's amazing. And going back and digging from your childhood, I know you mentioned you were around your father, your grandfather, very entrepreneurial. That whole side of India was very entrepreneur spirited. So it's in your DNA. What made you, or when that entrepreneur bug kicked in and said, you know what? I'm just taking the leap and I'm just going to go ahead and just do exponential what you're doing today. Like, what was going through your mind at that point and what made you kind of take that leap?
Yeah, it was again, boredom, right? So I've landed a very cushy job at the bank, senior position. I went from working 80-hour weeks to 30-hour weeks and had an executive assistant, small team, and I was still a rock star working 30-hour weeks. And I've just come from a family of workaholics, man. So I need to do something. And so side hobby, like, what do I know? I come from the technology world and I'm, you know, outsourcing and innovation. Let me start an outsourcing company and let's see how labor arbitrage works. And as I did that, I tested it out, A, from, hey, can I do this for the next 10 years without getting bored? And B, what am I learning? So I learned that I can scale anything super quickly, but it wasn't something that I wanted to do for 10 years. So I sold it off. Got some money, started a lending practice for house flippers and stuff. Got some other people's money. So I knew how to work with other people and get their funds in. And that led to a journey of, huh, these residential flippers and wholesalers earn more money than I would ever. It's just house lending. And there's a limit to how much I can lend because it's my money and plus a few other people. There has to be some other way of scalability. So that, again, that bug went in and like, I couldn't be them. And so 2019, I started my wholesaling and flipping business. And then I scaled it up to 10 employees. And at one point, I was sending 70,000 texts a month and, you know, flipping paper like anything. But again, I wasn't enjoying what I was doing. So that led me to another introspection. It's been a journey of really being aware and talking to myself and pivoting when I'm clear that this is something I want to do or not do. And not worry about the noise. And that's what something that came from my dad and my granddad was, one thing, be completely non-flashy and be completely frugal, right? And that was how they operated. They had hustled too. They would go to FedEx companies and they're like, can we rent your warehouse and not even pay for it? And they would use the FedEx trucks and warehouses without paying a dime. They never owned a warehouse and we'll ship things to the trucks for state. For 30 years, and there was just through relationships. They've never had a flashy office or any of that. And so that's how I grew is, you know, if I'm clear, I don't need noise saying somebody else is doing this, somebody else is doing that. I would change pretty quickly. And that's helped me through this evolution of my businesses and my journey in life.
That's awesome. That's tremendous. That is tremendous. The concept of not listening to the noise and kind of sticking to your core values and doing what you believe your mission statement happens to be. And that mission statement can change, obviously, over time because you're the one that's changing it and you're determining that. But you're not determining that based on popular noise or whatever, you know, outside external pressures are bringing in on you. That's tremendously important, you know, in a lot of successful entrepreneurs, because it's, you know, if you have to stop and listen to outside noise on every little step you do, you're never going to get ahead. You're never going to, I mean, it's because a lot of times noise is going to tell you something that you should not be doing that may end up being your biggest successes. And it's been proven over and over again through many, many companies that that's been the case. You know, so many companies, you hear endless stories of successful companies from Apple on down to people or whatever, telling them like, oh, you shouldn't be doing this product or you shouldn't be doing this line or you shouldn't be doing this venture because that's a bad time to do it. That's not the right product to do it. That's not the right way to do it.
Exactly.
But they believed in it so doggedly that they pushed forward and it doesn't matter. You know, again, I'm not saying that to be mistaken with course correction along the way and learning, because that is, you do absolutely have to learn and course correct along the way. You know?
Yeah. I think Jim Rohn had a quote that I love. It's be a student, not a follower, right? You always learn, you process it yourself. You understand what could mean for your journey. But if you follow anything or anyone blindly, that could lead to a potentially dangerous situation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I 100% agree. That's fantastic. So let's, you know, I'm herding us forward towards what you are doing now. So you've tried a couple of different ventures. You did a lending, you did a labor arbitrage. And then you thought like, oh, you know, man, I don't have enough to do with my time. Let me start a commercial real estate company.
Yeah. Yeah. So end of 2019, I was getting not bored, but I wasn't liking the conversation I was having with distressed sellers for these flipping houses, you know, type of contracts. I had 10 employees. I could scale them to 100. I could make multiple seven figures a year, easy in that business with VAs for the most part. It was a great, great business of earning money, but not bringing happiness in myself. And so at that, you know, whenever you had that point, I believe that a teacher appears. And so I had listened to Brandon Turner, Bigger Pockets guy. He spoke at that point how he hired a performance coach, and that kind of helped him pivot his life. So I started stalking that performance coach on Instagram, trying to understand that the way he puts words, it resonates with me or not. And I quickly found out, okay, this seemed like a good conversation, at least for me, this pivot that I need for the next 6 months. I need someone else to tell me what I probably in my heart of heart know. So I call him January of 2020, 2 months before COVID hits. I'm still working as a senior vice president. I have the wholesaling clipping business going in full swing. And I'm like, okay, Jason, his name is Jason. Jason, I have this conundrum in my life. I have something that I could 10x on a ton of money, but I'm unhappy with it, or I don't know what to do. And so he was like, you need to shut down your business. And the rationale that he provided was, you cannot climb up a new mountain unless you climb down the one that you own. And you cannot go from a senior executive at Accenture to senior vice president at the bank to flipping houses. You can't do that. It's not going to work out for you long term. You have to find something where you are actually getting into that senior executive role and can work at that and operate at that level. I'm like, dude, I have nothing. So he's like, but yeah, you got your job. What are you afraid of? Yeah, you'll lose some money with opportunity cost, but what are you afraid of? So I took his advice. I shut down an entire stream of revenue for me in January of 2020, and then COVID hit. So that was a blessing, because I was trying to figure out, how can I get, a new place? Can I build a new hotel? I was looking at hotels because a bunch of friends are building one. I'm glad I didn't do that. And that's when I stumbled across real estate syndication. I'm like, this is amazing, because it allows me to stay in my lane on what I like to do best. And that, allows me to build a team, really build a company that can mirror over a Fortune 100 company, even though it doesn't have to be size-wise that big, but, let's see where it goes. So started learning about it through five passive investments with five intentionally specific operators. Some were up and coming, some were seasoned, and just to get their playbooks, right? So management consulting 101, they should want to understand your competition, you get competitive intelligence and everybody's playbook, and then you build your own. So we did that for 5 months. I had my business partner, Yamesh, at that time, he and I talked. I'm like, hey, this is something that I know that you are completely complementary to me. Do you want to team up and go for this? And so we made that a focused, intentional decision to actually build the company and not just doing the passive investment. And that's how we got started. September of 2020, we got going until basically now. We've met four divisions within the company.
That's awesome.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm excited. I've been blessed to witness this journey from almost from day one, because I think I met you right when you were still leaving your job and getting ready to launch Exponential.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So I'm even thankful to be witness to your growth and to your journey.
Yeah. And it's great that, every decision should be intentional. And I love how the fact that if you're going to go in on something, you need to be intentional with your decisions, and you be intentional with how you're going to get this company up and going. And the fact that you purposely did your investments, your passive investments, for you to also get that know-how from those either seasoned or up and coming sponsors, everything like that has to definitely be intentional. And I think you've been doing everything right. You're playing chess for sure.
Like Barrett Crooks, don't play chess, not checkers. Yeah.
Yeah. And so look, Hemal, we're coming towards the end of our episode. So we're probably going to go in to our fire round. John, I'll let you kind of get started on this one.
Yeah, I would say this is going to be an easy question. Well, easy for me to ask, maybe not so easy for you to answer necessarily. But what would you say the biggest takeaway, or maybe the biggest lesson you've learned in the past? I'm not even going to go back to your childhood. I would say just in the past 5 years, three to 5 years of your journey from different levels of non-entrepreneurship to entrepreneurship to launching, you know, a couple of different companies. What is the biggest lesson you've taken away in the past 3 to 5 years? Give me two answers, one about yourself and one about your business.
Yeah, I think about myself is reminding myself on a daily basis that you play fast in the micro and slow in the macro. You got to make sure every day counts and, you know, be focused on the process, which is a cliched statement, but you don't worry about the outcome. You be focused on the list, planning next day, whether it's with my workout, whether it's the way I eat. And that comes from a vision of, hey, if I take something, I want to be the top 1% of that. So right now I'm on a fitness journey. My role as a father, my role as a husband, my role as a leader of the company, all of that, I want to be the best 1% of the world in terms of what I do. And so that, you know, defines my days. And I'm very intentional in fast in the micro. But I also know that some of these things take time. It could take 5 years, 6 months, 8 months. So I don't put in dates like other people. I don't put in, hey, I need to be 1,000 doors. I need to be 10% body weight in 2 months. I want to do 75 hard. I just say I want to be the top 1%. And that never lead me. It'll take whatever it will take.
And that's I love that. Yeah. Fast in the micro, slow in the macro. I love that. What was the second part about your business that you've learned?
So my business, it's been, if I have the clarity to define where I, and if I can master and understand the market cycle, which I believe I'm pretty good at, I can do non-conventional stuff and generate extreme amount of returns versus the lowest risk that most people create in this business. And that has allowed us to pivot multiple times over the last 5 years, came from not from a professional to non-professional, and then within commercial estate. I mean, that's how we did our land company, our development company. We bought this new foreign fund center. All of those are chess pieces to get us to that journey and thinking in a way that nobody else thinks, and that's okay. And I, as long as I'm super clear about what we are doing, I think we'll be in a great shape.
Tremendous. Tremendous. Francisco?
Yep. Yeah. So I'm a big believer in that private disciplines really pave the way for public success. And so a lot of what you just mentioned, going to second to John's question, what you said on what you learned from past 5 years, with that comes a lot of discipline, a lot of strategic habits. What are some of those private disciplines that you have now and that you can share with the audience with some of the private disciplines and some of those strategic habits that you have today?
Yeah, it's, again, starts from a belief. So whenever I talk to myself, there are two things I say to myself. One, if I do something, I'm going to do it 100%. And B, it doesn't matter what time frame it takes, I'm just going to do it. Right. Whether it's hiking, I hike Machu Picchu as the most unfit person out of the entire group. And I told them, I'm like, hey, I got my rock songs. I'm going to do my jam. There's no signal. You guys can be 2 hours ahead of me. And that's fine. I'll be there, man. I'm going to show up. And that's how I show up in life. Right? So I show up on a daily basis from that perspective. But then private discipline, I think the health has been my biggest game changer, just to be very tactical. And again, hiring a coach, any place where I needed help, I went out and sought help without any ego. I didn't say that I know everything, and I hired a coach. And then when I found someone who was willing to do and had results that you could be derived, then I just followed them to the T. I don't devote any thinking or energetic time. Once I find a coach and they say, I have this game plan, you just do that and your life will be amazing. And that's what I've done. And I'm in the best shape of my life ever. Right.
That is amazing. That is great. Yeah. Cause I, and kind of just chime in into what you just said. I mean, I think that that's a skill all of its own, being able to just come in without an ego and just be vulnerable on things that you don't know. And you go out and you seek help on those areas, because I think there's, especially us as leaders, as shakers and movers in the industry, we at times feel that pressure, that kind of almost like a burden that, hey, you know what? I need to know everything, but you don't really need to know everything. You can go out, you can be vulnerable and say, you know what? I don't know this, but let me go and find out. And I think that takes a lot of skill for someone to be able to be self-aware that, you know what? I can't do this, but let me go ahead and seek help for that specific area where I'm weak at.
Yeah, I don't think you can be authentic to yourself if you don't do that. I don't believe in the whole fake it till you make it crap at the end of the day. Either I am or I'm not. And if I'm not, I'll find someone. If I want to be that way intentionally, I'll find someone who does it amazingly and borrow their playbook and build my own.
I agree with you, Hemal. I don't believe in the fake it till you make it. I believe into stepping into bigger shoes than fits Absolutely. You sometimes in order for you to grow into those shoes. Because, Yes. You know, it's not as you don't need to fake anything, but it's okay for you to take on challenges that are bigger than you. In fact, you should take on challenges bigger than you. That's how you grow. That's the only way to grow. You know, if you don't take on challenges bigger than you, if you don't take on a challenge and you look at this challenge and think, man, this is going to kick my ass. Like, I don't know if I can do this. Then that means that's the right challenge for you. You know, if you look at a challenge and go, oh man, this is going to be a piece of pie. That's not the right way.
It's not big enough.
Yeah. 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 Especially this business is not for the faint of heart, right? We solve tremendous amounts of problems. Some of them big, big problems involving multi-million dollar of equity, debt. I mean, they, you know, could wipe
yeah.
us.
Oh yeah.
Right. And so, you got to be clear. You got to be confident in what you do and what you don't know. So there has to be a level of self-belief that most people might not even have in order to operate in this business and solve this problem completely.
Well, I think to Francisco's point, sometimes you have to take steps on things that you don't maybe not have all the data on. Like you're going to, and that's just the nature of the beast. We have to execute on things that we know enough about to make headway and to be successful at or to figure out, but we're not going to have all the data. I mean, I'm never going to have all the data. I'm not, you know, like people ask me like, you know, oh, do you have confidence in the market? Like, I don't know I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what the market is going to do. What I can tell you is what we do on a day-to-day basis. What I can tell you is how we look at underwriting. What I can tell you is how we look at deals when they come our way and how we, you know, how we approach our numbers and how we approach our acquisitions. That I can control and I can tell you how we do. And yeah. hopefully through doing these repetitive steps over and over again, we end up exposing ourselves to things that are going to fit our shoes at some point. And we become that crystal ball that we're hoping yeah. to see. So, you know, no, I'm never going to know what's going to happen tomorrow. I'm never going to know what's going to happen in the industry. I'm never going to guarantee you that I'm going to be the biggest sage in the industry. That would be foolish, you know?
Yeah. That's a good segue. We're rebranding to Sage Equity. So we want to be the biggest sages in the industry.
I like it. I love it. Oh man. Well, that is it for me, my friend. We awesome. Totally appreciate you being here with us. It's been a pleasure as always. How would people know where to reach you? How would people find you? You want to kind of give us a little snippet and they'll be in the show notes as well, but give us where people can find you.
So yeah, we are rebranding. So at some point we'll be called sageequity.com and you'll see Sage at all our buildings too. Plaster our name and our legacy onto it and show people the progress that we're making across the Carolinas. In the meantime, my email address is Hemal, H-E-M-A-L, at exponential-equity.com. That's our company name, exponential-equity. I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook. So you can connect me and I love talking about real estate. So anybody who's looking, any of your listeners and looking to more about ground up construction, land, foreign funds, multifamily, is the Carolinas. Happy to chat about multiple asset classes with you all.
Amazing. Awesome. Amazing. Awesome. A breadth of information. Hemal Badiani, thank you so much again for joining us, my man.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to the Breaking Resistance podcast show with John Azar and myself, Francisco Herrera. To learn more about our current projects, please visit our website at www.peak15cap.com or reach out to us directly at Herrera@peak15cap.com or Azar@peak15cap.com. We thank you for joining and tune in for our shows Mondays and Thursdays, where we bring you more guests to fuel your inspiration.